This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman, filling in for Ira today. You know the phrase, you are what you eat? Well, new research suggests a slight modification. Your gut bacteria are what you eat. And if you eat more red meat, for example, you'll nurture populations of microbes that like to eat red meat too, which might not seem like a bad thing, except that researchers have pinpointed a compound in red meat called L-carnitine that, when broken down by gut bacteria, might contribute to heart disease. So the more bugs you have to break it down, the worse off you might be. It's another culprit, like cholesterol and fat, linking red meat to heart disease. Is it time to swear off steak? Dr. Stanley Hazen is chair of the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at the Lerner Research Institute at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. He's also lead author on the red meat study in the journal Nature Medicine. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hazen.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more about this compound, L-carnitine.
So carnitine is a form of an amino acid. We make it in our own bodies. All of the carnitine that we need, we make from our diet. We just make it on our own. And it plays an essential role in energy metabolism. It helps to take fatty acids into something called the mitochondria, which is the powerhouse of the cell, and burn fatty acids as fuel. And while the carnitine is not an essential nutrient, that means that we don't need to have it in our diet. We actually synthesize all the carnitine that we need from protein, and that protein can be either from plant or animal. So even vegetarians or vegans make all the carnitine that they need from their diet.
And so what's the problem about getting a little bit extra?
Well, what our studies show is that in our digestive tract, we have many, many bugs, so microbes. They can digest carnitine. We can't. We get no calories from carnitine, but the bugs do. A byproduct that the microbes make gets released and converted in our bodies and detected in the blood into a compound that actually helps promote clogging of the arteries or cholesterol deposition in the artery wall. It does this by actually changing our metabolism of cholesterol. So this is not independent of cholesterol. It actually works through cholesterol. It changes how our body senses cholesterol and metabolizes cholesterol at the artery wall, in the liver, and in the intestines.
So let me see if I have this straight. So we eat red meat. It has carnitine in it. Microbes in our body break it down, produce another compound, and that's TMAO? Is that right?
That's TMA. That then is actually a gas, believe it or not, at body temperature. It smells like rotting fish, but we don't smell like rotting fish when we eat meat. That's because it goes straight to the liver through what the portal circulation, and there's a cluster of enzymes in the liver that get rid of that compound and turn it into something called TMAO. And that compound is the one that actually tracks with cardiovascular risk and promotes atherosclerosis. Both in animal studies, we're able to show that if you feed animals carnitine, they got accelerated atherosclerosis. And they did so in a TMAO-dependent fashion. If you gave them antibiotics to suppress their intestinal flora, they no longer made the TMAO. They no longer got accelerated atherosclerosis. If you give the downstream metabolite, TMAO, you get accelerated atherosclerosis. And then in humans, we went ahead and measured this metabolite of the carnitine, TMAO, and were able to show that blood levels of this metabolite very strongly predict future risks for heart attack, stroke, and death.
But not everybody produces the same amount when they're given the same meal, right?
That was actually some of the more surprising finding of the study. When we looked at the metabolism of carnitine, we compared omnivores as compared to vegetarian or vegans, we saw strikingly different results. The omnivore, that is the individual who eats both animal products, meat, as well as vegetables, they actually metabolized carnitine very readily and formed TMAO that was detected in the blood. In contrast, the long-standing vegetarian or vegan, and to be enrolled in our study, the subjects had to claim that they had no animal or no meat product within the last year. So they were long-standing vegetarian or vegan. When they ingested carnitine, they made virtually no TMAO. And we then subsequently analyzed the microbes in the feces, in the stool, and could show that the composition of the microbes in the from the gut in the omnivore were very different from what we found in the vegetarian or vegan, and the types of microbes that actually were involved in breaking down carnitine were not found as much in the vegetarian or vegan and were abundant in the omnivore.
So you think that if you eat a lot of meat, you've sort of grown a different microbial community that's better adapted or different species that will actually break down the carnitine more efficiently than than if you just eat vegetables?
How you said it is exactly correct. And in fact, to test that, what we actually looked at was we took animals who are on a normal chow diet, which is rather vegetarian, and then added carnitine to it, and then compared the capacity to make TMAO in the normal chow versus carnitine-supplemented animals, as well as looked at the microbial composition and what we in their stool or in their cecum, that's a portion of their gut. And what we found is that the animals that were on the chronic carnitine-containing diet, they made over 10 to 100-fold more TMAO from a carnitine bolus that was given into their stomach compared to the animals that were on the normal chow diet.
So that they made more of the compound that tracks with cardiovascular risk.
Yes.
If they'd been eating meat. So when you talk about red meat, is it more than beef?
It is. So carnitine is found in many things. So carnitine comes from the same root word as carnivore. So carnis means flesh. So carnitine was discovered over 100 years ago. And the chemists who discovered it called it carnitine because it was found in animal products, things made of flesh. And if you look at multiple different types of meat products, you find that the red ones, so beef, lamb, mutton, venison, these have higher levels, even duck, and certain types of fish that have red fleshy meat, they have higher levels of carnitine. And then the white meats and the poultry and the other fish that, you know, the white fish have much, much lower levels of carnitine.
Do you have dietary suggestions based on this? Can you maybe still eat red meat but also eat things that encourage bacteria that compete with these TMAO-producing microbes?
Well, we didn't actually. I can make some suggestions, but they're kind of common sense guesses. They're not based on actual clinical studies yet. What our studies showed that if you cut out all red meat, all meat, and became vegetarian or vegan after a long time, you would actually, that's a surefire way to be able to make virtually no TMAO from carnitine. Because every longstanding vegetarian or vegan who we looked at, who was not on any kind of supplements or anything and was just a longstanding vegetarian, they did not generate TMAO. Now, on the other hand, what we don't know is if you are an omnivore and you switch to a vegetarian diet, how long before you start seeing this change occur? We know that it's going to be longer than a week, but we don't know if it's going to be. It's somewhere between a week and a year. We don't have any information on the more specific than that.
It's amazing to me that you can change the bacteria that live in your gut just by what you eat. I mean, it makes sense, but if you think of it as an ecosystem in there, but it's surprising.
Well, that's exactly what it is, an ecosystem. It's a closed terrarium, if you will, and there's only so much food. And so if you change the composition of what you're eating, the types of microbes that like what you're eating will proliferate more so than the types that don't. And there's only so much space and so much nutrient available. And so the reason why I think it showed up so clearly in this situation is we're talking about a nutrient that we do not, we don't digest ourselves. Mm-hmm. We get no calories from carnitine. And we're looking at a byproduct of the bacterial metabolism of the carnitine. So this is the waste product of the bacteria, and that then our bodies have developed a call it a detoxifying mechanism to get rid of this thing called the gas that stinks called TMA.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could see a very dramatic difference in the subjects, because the vegan or vegetarian who has very little carnitine in the diet, after a long period of time, the microbes that really critically depend on carnitine for sustenance, their numbers just dwindle. And other microbes that, let's say, are good at flourishing on leaf litter or, you know, vegetable parts, they increase in number.
I have really 2 minutes left, but I want to go to the phones quickly for a very fast, quick question. Troy in Iowa City, what's your question?
Yes, my question is how much carnitine does a steak have, and did you just raise it to very, very high levels to get that bacteria? So why don't just lions and tigers, like, die at the age of, like, two then?
Thanks, Troy.
Because their bacteria is better than ours?
Good question.
Okay, it is a good question. So first, heart disease or clogging of the arteries, atherosclerosis, is not a disease, at least in humans and big animals, that happens quickly. In us, it takes decades to develop, so and most of the time. So that's why, thankfully, kids, teenagers, even 20, 30-year-olds usually don't have heart attacks. It happens in middle-aged and older. So this is not an acute, very fast thing. It takes a long time. And most of the carnivorous animals have a shorter lifespan. They may get atherosclerotic plaque. I don't know. But they usually don't live more than a 10-year period, as far as I can tell.
Huh.
The second question you said was, how much is in a steak? Well, a typical steak is thought to have about 180 milligrams on average of carnitine. And the amount that we were giving in a capsule for our studies was 250 milligrams. The amount that you find on the grocery store in supplement form varies anywhere from 200, 250 milligrams to 500 milligrams.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you, Dr. Hazen, for joining us. Really fascinating work.
Thank you.
Dr. Hazen is the chair of the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at the Lerner Research Institute at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. We'll be right back with Mary Roach. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from NPR. Up next, another mover and shaker in the alimentary canal, coffee. Whether you're a home brewer or a latte devotee, whether you take it light and sweet or on ice, your coffee is guaranteed to be chock full of chemistry. It starts in the bean, which is actually not a bean at all. It's a seed, according to Harold McGee, author of On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, along with other books on science of food. And we caught up with Harold to hear more about how coffee gets its signature taste.
If you don't mind, maybe what I'll do is back up and just talk about what's in the coffee seed and how it got there. You start out with a raw coffee bean, which is very hard. If you try to bite into it, it's like biting into a pinto bean. You might break your tooth before you actually get into it. And it has no flavor, or if any flavor at all, it's kind of like a stale green pea with a kind of astringent, woody flavor to it, not much aroma at all, just kind of irritating. So if you make an infusion of green coffee beans, that's mostly what you get, is acidity and bitterness from the caffeine. And then what happens is that you roast that bean and generate hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new chemical compounds that are locked into that bean and give it all kinds of flavor qualities, taste, aroma, mouthfeel, body. It's really a miraculous kind of thing. You then end up, after roasting, with this bean that's full of hundreds and hundreds of chemicals that you want to get into the water that's going to form the bulk of the drink. So you grind up the bean to increase the surface area that's going to get exposed to the water, and then you heat the water up because extraction of molecules from a solid happens much faster at higher temperatures. Everything's just jumping around a lot faster and with more energy, and so you're able to knock out the desirable flavors from the bean much more readily at high temperatures than you are at low temperatures. And then you expose the bean to that water and leave the two materials in contact with each other long enough to extract the really good stuff, but not so long that you extract the not so good stuff, because there are things in the bean that are not so pleasant.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman, chatting with Harold McGee. Is it just luck that they come out later?
I would say basically the things that come out early are small molecules and very water-soluble molecules, so acids. The things that come out very late are not so water-soluble, and they're larger molecules. And it turns out that those are the ones that do tend to be bitter and do tend to be astringent.
Would we be familiar with any of these chemicals? Do we, you know, or are they things we've never heard of before?
No, they're found in all other roasted foods, or most other roasted foods. And that's one of the amazing things about the Maillard reactions. Those are that's the general term for these reactions that at high temperatures turn pale, tasteless things into brown, tasty things. So a lot of the things that you find in coffee, you also find in other toasted, roasted foods. The few that make coffee coffee tend to be, as far as we can tell, and we're still learning about this, tend to be very peculiar sulfur-containing aromatic molecules that you just don't find other places.
Sulfur, I mean, we know that from things like skunk spray.
Yes.
Maybe different ones.
It's true. Yes, they are different, although you do find some overlap between defensive sprays of animals and foods that we love. You have to get the proportions right. So if there's too much of it, then, of course, you're not going to like it. But a little bit gives a kind of depth and interest to food flavors.
Did you say that caffeine is bitter? Does that mean caffeine has a flavor itself?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Caffeine is it's an alkaloid. And we find humans, that is, find almost all alkaloids bitter. And the biological thinking about that is that almost all alkaloids are also toxic. And our bitter taste, which is an intrinsically unpleasant experience, bitterness is a way of warning us that there's something in whatever we've put in our mouth that is likely to be bad for us. Now, you might say, well, but we love caffeine because it does wonderful things for our attentiveness and wakefulness and so on. And that's true to a certain point. But if you have too much caffeine, it will, in fact, be toxic. So bitterness is a flavor that we learn to enjoy in the course of our lives because we can associate it with desirable things like the delicious flavors of coffee and the stimulating effects of coffee. But initially, it's an unpleasant experience.
It's kind of an upper downer about the caffeine, right? Anyway, that was Harold McGee, author of On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, and we chatted with him from KQED in San Francisco. That's about all we have time for this hour. If you want to learn more about the science of coffee, visit our website. We have a video produced by Jenny Woodward featuring Harold McGee and overflowing with fun facts on coffee. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our assistant producer is Eli Chen. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director. And Manoli Weatherall is at the controls today. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, of course, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video, on iTunes and on our Android apps. If you'd like to write us, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. The Big Cheese will be back next week. I'm Flora Lichtman in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block. And if there were any justice in this world, I'd be having this next conversation over some boiled peanuts and a big plate of roasted oysters in Charleston, South Carolina right now. But instead, I'm here in Washington, D.C., looking at a copy of the Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen Cookbook. Ted Lee joins me from New York, but his brother Matt Lee is in Charleston. Lucky you, Matt. Matt and Ted, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Matt and Ted, do me a favor. Just conjure up, would you, a meal sort of start to finish, a really typical, fantastic Charleston menu. Where would you start?
I would start with kumquat sparklers with the flavor of backyard kumquats, which are like tangerines. Also classic Charleston cheese biscuits with a single pecan pressed into it and savory Benny wafers, sesame seed wafers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Ted, next course?
Moving on to soup, we do a she crab soup, and then we do a shrimp and grits. For vegetables, I think this is the perfect time to do chaney briar. It's growing really well out on Sullivan's Island. We do some grilled chaney briar, and also for some color contrast, sweet potatoes on the plate. We make them with sorghum marshmallows. And for dessert, Matt, what do you think?
I think Huguenot tort.
Huguenot tort. What's Huguenot tort?
Huguenot tort has this nice meringue-like crisp top, but then a sludgy caramel and apple and pecan bottom to it. It's got flour, but tons of leavening, so it just puffs up in the oven, then collapses and creates this very interesting and uniquely Charleston dessert.
Oh, man, you're just making us all so hungry right now.
Come on down.
Oh, I wish I could. The two of you have focused in a couple of books before on Southern food, but now you're really drilling in on the city where you grew up. You were born in New York, but you moved to Charleston when you were a kid. So what is it about Charleston food that has such personality? How would you describe it, Matt?
Well, it's naturally about the seafood and also about the poultry. The much-heralded, like, Porkopolis of the South doesn't really exist so much in Charleston because it was never a place to raise cattle or pigs, being so marshy.
And, Ted, it also involves, I mean, from the book I can tell, it involves a lot of local produce. I mean, you describe going out with a farmer to get fresh collards. You seems like it's still pretty easy to get fresh stuff right off the farm.
Yeah, I think another thing that visitors to Charleston are surprised by is just how close the farms are, the rural part of Charleston to the city. And another thing is that even downtown, we grew up downtown in the historic district, we're surrounded by fruits of all kinds like kumquats, loquats, mulberries, figs, pomegranates, bananas, citrus. They all grow downtown and you grow up sort of knowing where the trees are and which ones taste best.
And if they're not in your own yard, you have some techniques for foraging,
yes.
or should we just say stealing from other people's trees?
Foraging,
what's the secret?
Stealing, pretending that you know the old widow's grandson. There are a lot of secrets and back alleys in Charleston that yield great fruits and herbs.
And what's the secret for foraging without getting in trouble?
Secret for foraging? Be very polite, first
Wear
of all.
Wear a smile.
Wear a smile.
That's awfully disarming.
I've got to ask you both about a recipe you have in your book, grilled chaney briar. Matt, what is chaney briar?
Chaney briar is a native weed or vine. It's smilax botanically, and it's something that grows on fence lines. It grows on the sand dunes at the beaches, and it has in the spring right about now a tender tip, a shoot that is delicious. And it's considered wild asparagus by some people in Charleston. Other people call it chaney briar. And it never appears in restaurants or in grocery stores. It's just one of those things that you have to live here to really appreciate.
Is it an acquired taste? I'm looking at the photograph. It looks like a tangle of stuff that you might mow or clip from your garden.
It's right. Pretty rangy, and that's the appeal in terms of flavor. I mean, it tastes like asparagus, but with this extra sort of reckless green thing. Sometimes we describe it as tasting like asparagus with olive oil already on it.
Mm. You've written about the tension in Charleston between the past and the present in cooking, and I wonder how that shows up as you're looking at recipes for the book.
This is Ted speaking. We find a lot of inspiration in old cookbooks, especially ones from the 19th century, and we think they tell a story that's so diverse and varied about the different kinds of vegetables that were grown in the Lowcountry, some of which are rarely found, like salsify, tanya.
Which is,
it's a root vegetable. And it's just interesting the ways in which you discover new things by looking in old books. It's nice to be able to draw from the past to inform your kitchen in the present.
Well, one of the cookbooks that I know you draw on is a famous one from the 1950s, a Junior League cookbook called Charleston Receipts. But I'm also fascinated by one that you mentioned called Cooking for That Man. Tell me about that one, Matt.
Cooking for That Man is a cookbook from the Ravenel, South Carolina area, due south of Charleston. It's a community cookbook, and what we love about it, what drew us to it, is that it contained a recipe attributed to an old Charleston area destination restaurant called the Edisto Motel Restaurant. This was a place that for a long time in the 20th century just drew carloads of festive Charlestonians to stand in line with a beer in the hand for hours waiting for the most gorgeous blonde platters of fried shrimp, oysters, flounder, whiting you've ever seen. And I don't know why it went out of business, but in any case, their deviled crab recipe was contained in Cooking for That Man.
That man.
We don't know who that man is.
He could be anyone.
Could be anybody.
In your dessert section in this book, you have a recipe from the 1700s that you say really deserves a revival, and it's for something with the absolutely fantastic name, syllabub.
Syllabub. Despite the fact that it appears in all the old cookbooks, Matt and I have never been served it either in a Charleston restaurant or in a Charleston home. And so we just tried it ourselves. And it's basically very simple. It's fortified wine that's been seasoned with lemon juice and lemon peel, a little bit of sugar, sometimes spices, and whipped with cream until it's sort of this airy, fluffy, alcoholic whipped cream that goes really well with fruit. It's so easy.
Oh, it sounds so good. Ted and Matt Lee, thanks so much. It's been really fun to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Ted and Matt Lee, their book is The Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. And if you happen to have some Cheney Briar growing wild near you, you'll find a recipe for how to grill it, along with recipes for Huguenot tort and syllabub. It's at npr.org.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Peter Alina and Kurt Stalnicker.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Viet Le, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, Brendan Banizak, Janae West, Bilal Qureshi, and Jessica Deal.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.